DEI that you don't even know the definition of. You don't even understand the definition of DEI. You don't understand that it helps veterans, that it helps disabled people, that it helps women. You don't understand that. Just little things like things where a woman can go into a private room and breastfeed and or pump milk, or any of those things. Or veterans have equal access to the job market. Or disabled people can get a ramp so that they can get to work. Just little things. And you think it's all because, like, you think it's about black people who are not deserving of your jobs, who are less qualified than you, and they're stealing your jobs. That's what you think it is. That's what they want you to think it is, because they want to keep you fighting. And you have fallen for it with your stupid MAGA brain. Because you are in a cult and it makes you feel like you belong to something. It makes you feel, you're welcome, Nicole Luongo. Thank you for mentioning disabled people like me. And anyone else who knows what DEI does, who it actually helps, put it in the chat and we'll educate you. But because you want to belong to something, it makes you feel like you're part of the club. They don't care about anything other than the ability to be hateful, says Brittany SF. In the meantime, Donald Trump is still going around saying that the election results are not true, even though he won. He still doesn't believe that they're true, except for him. So if the election results are not true, then maybe he actually did not get the votes. Maybe folks are right. They're saying that Elon Musk tampered. That's what people are saying, right? You've heard it. That there was some tampering with the votes electronically. Well, this is what he said in an interview. Listen, I want you to listen closely and tell me if this makes sense.
They really do. You won the popular vote. You won all the swing states. But still, Kamala Harris got 75 million votes in the country.
Well, if you believe the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's just say.
It is ridiculous.
The election was as it was.
There are seven swing states. I won them all.
You did.
By a lot.
But let me just get to the dismount here.
And I won the popular.
Have you thought about how to try to bring the country together, to reach out or to find common ground? Have you thought about that? Or
can you imagine how tiny this person's self-esteem is? To always be so constantly obsessed with numbers and who got the most or whatever. So if it was not accurate, then perhaps his votes are not accurate. So what he's saying doesn't make sense. So shouldn't he be saying, like, look, yeah, I won fair and square. This is a free and fair election, but yet and still he just can't admit it. That the election was within 1% or whatever, a very tiny percentage of the vote. He will tell you it's a mandated landslide. It was not a landslide. So Donald Trump is still lying to people. Still lying. Putting us into a what? Right now, we are in a constitutional crisis, and I have been telling you this, and it's all based on lies and that Donald Trump and this administration, they don't give a damn about the Constitution. Neither do they care about the rule of law. I think Democrats have finally gotten it, but I think it may be a little bit too late because there's not much that they can do. Elizabeth Warren.
Isn't actually the guy who puts in the orders and cuts people's paychecks. There's somebody else in the system who does that. And they're a click down from Donald Trump and a click down from that and a click down from that. And when a federal court issues an order and then gets people in front of them and says, you either follow that order or find yourself in contempt. Now we're going to see whether or not those are people who are going to say, oh, but Donald Trump told me. And a judge is going to say, I don't care what Donald Trump told you. I'm telling you what the law is. You follow the law. And, you know, my view right now is the courts are where we are hanging on to our constitutional structure. They still have the power to hold everybody else in this country in contempt if they do not follow lawfully issued court orders.
Except, Elizabeth Warren, Maybe in a state court, and that will hold true, but not in federal court where most of this will take place. They are really immune. There are no consequences. I hate to be Donnie Downer, but let me just tell you, Donald Trump will say, I'm acting in the official capacity as president. The Supreme Court granted me that right. And if you prosecute anyone that I give orders to, I'm just going to pardon them. And they are not going to suffer any consequences. And I'm going to bring them back, and I'm going to keep them in the government. That, my dears, that is a constitutional crisis. And we are in one right now. So what do we do? I don't know. Elizabeth Warren is hanging her hat on the courts. Good luck. Because we see what happens with the courts now. You know what's happening with the courts? Governor Rod Blagojevich. All of it wiped away. Donald Trump. Pardon him. I believe it's a pardon, right? Am I correct, producers? It's a pardon. Eric Adams. Donald Trump's Justice Department has ordered the courts in New York, the federal courts, to drop all of the charges against who? Eric Adams. Department of Justice. Can we call the Department of Justice? Someone says in the chat, you can call them. I don't know if it's going to make a difference. I'm just being honest with you guys. I don't know. And here's something else that will happen. Because there's breaking news coming out. It says Steve Bannon pleads guilty in New York. We build a wall case. So you remember that whole case with Steve Bannon where they said that it was fraudulent. He actually served time. Steve Bannon, a longtime ally of President Donald Trump, pleaded guilty on Tuesday on a fraud charge in a case alleging he helped defraud donors who were giving money to build a wall at the southern U.S. border. In exchange for a guilty plea, he agreed to a conditional discharge and waived his right to appeal. Bannon was sentenced to 3 years conditional discharge. He will not be allowed to serve as an officer or a director of a charity or any charitable organization in New York State or any fundraising or not-for-profit organization in New York State. This is state court, so Donald Trump doesn't have jurisdiction. He will not be allowed to receive or hold assets for any charitable organizations. He was originally charged in an indictment with 6 counts of money laundering, conspiracy, and a scheme to defraud. So Steve Bannon in state court couldn't save him from that. So maybe in these state courts, Elizabeth Warren is right. But in the federal court, nope, they are lawless. Dorothy Taylor. Dorothy, why aren't you a member? You should be a member. Eric Adams will now kiss his boots and ring as well. So Eric Adams, not suffering any consequences. Rod Blagojevich, he's already paid somewhat because he went to jail. George Conway. You guys know George Conway. Kellyanne Conway's ex-husband, who is a never-Trumper, has never liked Donald Trump. Even when his wife was trying to elect him, he was quiet then back during the campaign. And then afterwards, he's like, I've had enough of this. And then they got a divorce. Here's George Conway talking about the constitutional crisis and what the courts should be doing and are not. Here it is.
This is, you know, the only recourse will be for people to get out and say, we want the rule of law. We want a government that obeys the law.
Pause.
And that's going to require people to go out.
Did you guys hear what I said yesterday and I've been saying all along that you need to take it to the streets? Sounds like George Conway is saying exactly what we said. Let's hear him out. Here it is.
That's going to require people to go out on the streets because there is no other alternative. It's telling us something that we should have already known. And last week I said it. They are not going to obey court orders. They have decided that they are going to push the boundaries on executive power by basically infringing on the Article 1 power of Congress. And they are violating the Constitution, the text of the Constitution in the birthright citizenship issue. They are violating the text of statutes by having Doge run around and do all the things that have been doing these executive orders. There's no reason that this government that has decided not to obey the laws and the Constitution of the United States is going to obey a court order. And as you know, Joe, having practiced law, there's really only one way that courts can enforce their orders when somebody is being contumacious or refusing to obey an order. And that's to send the U.S. Marshals out to take somebody in and to hold them in contempt or to otherwise enforce court orders. Well, who does the U.S. Marshals Service work for? Yep. The U.S. Marshals Service is part of the United States Department of Justice. It reports to Donald J. Trump.
Now, I had not heard this entire thing. I have not spoken to George Conway. George Conway is saying exactly what I've been saying. Constitutional crisis, there is no recourse. Perhaps in the state courts, people are too afraid to make sacrifices, says Kev, the creator. Yes, they are. But you got to make sacrifices. You're going to take to the streets. Maybe you don't care about your democracy. I don't know. Maybe you don't care about your son or your daughter or your husband or whatever facing the consequences of doing something that you think is not such a big deal. Perhaps they were wrong, but because they made a mistake. But yet, your relative, your friend, your neighbor, your loved one is going to be bogged down in the court, going to get caught up in the system, and going to have to pay the consequences, suffer the consequences. In the meantime, the folks who are really committing the big treasonous crimes against the country, they are going to get off scot-free. They are ruining our democracy. Let's listen. George is saying what I'm saying. Let's keep listening to George.
What's going to happen here, mark my words, is that at some point, they are going to basically tell the United States Marshals Service, do not enforce any of these orders. We will not obey them, mm-hmm. and you are not to enforce them. And once that happens, I hope it doesn't happen, but I know in my heart that it will. Our 236-year experiment in the federal rule of law, in democratic self-governance for the United States of America, in American constitutionalism, is essentially over. The courts have no mechanism to enforce their orders other than through the United States Marshals Service.
Yeah.
And thus through the Department of Justice, thus through the executive branch. The reason why we obey court orders is because the executive branch complies with court orders. If the executive branch does not comply with court orders and makes a point of saying that we will not comply with court orders, the rule of law, in as far as the federal government is concerned, is over. And that is something we need to start focusing on and discussing, because that's where these people will go. There is no logical stopping point for them.
Stop. Did you guys hear that? I've been saying that all along. Now, he broke it down as it relates to the U.S. Marshals Service. It's over. We are in a constitutional crisis. Donald Trump is a dictator. Donald Trump can basically do what he wants. I'm sorry. I know that you guys don't like to hear that unless you take to the streets and you start fighting back. They start fighting back in the courts. Yeah, Amanda Belcher, Jesus Christ, this is legit. This is terrifying. I've been trying to tell you guys that. I told you I'm not going to bombard you with stuff that it's not important. But when it comes to these issues as it relates to the law, that's the stuff I keep bringing you, because that's the important stuff I'm trying to tell you. He can do, I know it's hard to hear. He can do whatever he wants to. And the people around him can do whatever they want to. You heard Elizabeth Warren and others. I think George Conway may have mentioned Doge. You guys know who Sam Altman is, right? Sam Altman also has this OpenAI thing, and he's sort of in competition with Elon Musk. He knows Elon Musk. They're both in Silicon Valley. He had a few choice words to say about Elon Musk in an interview that he did. Here's Sam Altman.
Sam, of course, the headlines right now, Elon Musk making a bid
apparently
for OpenAI. Your response, you're turning him down for $97
billion. I mean, look, OpenAI is not for sale. The OpenAI mission is not for sale. Elon tries all sorts of things for a long time. This is this week's episode.
You take it seriously at all? What do you think he's trying to drive at with this?
I think he's probably just trying to slow us down. He obviously is a competitor. It's, you know, he's working hard and has raised a lot of money for XAI, and they're trying to compete with us from a technological perspective, from, you know, getting the product into the market. And I wish he would just compete by building a better product, but I think there's been a lot of tactics, you know, many, many lawsuits, all sorts of other crazy stuff, now this. And we'll try to just put our head down and keep working.
Does it make it more difficult to move from that nonprofit model to that for-profit model for OpenAI?
We're not moving to a for-profit model. We're not sure we're going to do it all, but no matter what, the nonprofit will continue to be extremely important. It will drive the mission. It will continue to exist. The board is looking at lots of options about how to best structure for this next phase, but the nonprofit is not changing into anything or going anywhere.
Okay. What is your main mission here at the Paris AI Action Summit? You got Stargate. There's question marks about how much you're actually going to commit to that. Maybe you can give us some numbers on that, Sam. What is the messaging here from you and the team?
So I've been to an earlier version of this at Bletchley Park, and that one was more focused on safety. This one, people are still talking about safety, but really I think people are now saying, okay, this technology is here. It's having an incredible impact. We've got to drive it. There is a lot of questions about how people can, you know, maybe the most common question I've gotten is, can you do a Stargate in my country? You know, we need infrastructure here. We want to do this. Can you help? So that's been a common one. But a lot of other things about just how are we going to deploy this technology to make sure people benefit? Where's it going to go? You know, in what ways is the model going to improve? Last week, we launched this thing called Deep Research. There's been a ton of questions about that. You know, how can we use this to really drive economic growth? But yeah, maybe economic growth has been the single biggest theme here.
And have you had clarity on DeepSeek? I know you and the team can be looking into that, whether they distilled, whether they inappropriately used your inferencing data. Have you had more clarity on that?
I mean, whether they did or didn't,
they
built a good model. Many people will distill from many other models. Again, I feel so confident about our research roadmap and also our product roadmap that, you know, DeepSeek will do whatever DeepSeek is going to do. Other people do whatever they're going to do. And we're just going to try to, like, build the best technology we can and get it into people's hands. And I think that's mostly going pretty well.
Do you think Musk's approach then is from a position of insecurity about XAI?
Probably his whole life is from a position of insecurity. I feel for the guy.
You feel for him?
I do, actually. I don't think he's like a happy person. I do feel for him.
Okay. Do you worry that he has this proximity to the president and he can influence the decision-making of the U.S. presidency and policies around this agenda on AI?
Not particularly. Maybe I should, but not particularly. I mean, I try to just wake up and think about, like, how we're going to make our technology better.
Okay. Sam Altman. Thank
Sam Altman. I like Sam Altman. He's good. Actually, met him once in, I was getting an award in San Francisco, and my friend was like, Florida, and I was asking a friend that we were having lunch with. I said, can you get me in touch with Sam Altman? I'd like to get him on the show. And he said, Don, you sat next to him for an hour when you got the award in San Francisco. And I went, oh my gosh, I totally forgot. And I already had his phone number in my thing. And so I want to get Sam Altman on the show. So guys, help me. If you email Sam Altman, tell him to come on the show. But Sam Altman is saying he thinks that he is a deeply unhappy person. And that's a person who is leading the charge as it relates to what happens economically in our country, at least with saving money and trying to, you know, get rid of so-called government overspending. Jen Psaki has, you guys know who Jack Schlossberg is? The nephew of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Caroline Kennedy's son. He was on with Jen Psaki, and I just want to play this. He and Jen Psaki had a fascinating conversation. We'll play a little bit of it, but he's talking about what's going on in the country, and he's out there. If you haven't seen him, go out, look on social media for Jack Schlossberg, but here he is.
What have you found, either from your own experimentation with playing around with social media platforms, or even just from listening to and consuming the products of some of the people you may totally disagree with works?
Yeah, I mean, I have like a few thoughts. I think one is the internet is like a nuanced destruction machine. And so there's no room for qualifying anything ever. Don't waste your time. If you're going to tweet something out, like make it so extreme that you can't. That it's completely, that's what Trump does. It's like a completely clear statement. Take it all the way. And that's the only thing that really resonates online because everything else, it's too confusing otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is you have to be controversial or unexpected. So you have to be very clear and you have to be very controversial in order to break through, I think. And conservatives are good at playing with that without getting in trouble. And I don't know that we've come up with our own style of being funny and taking risks. And people talk a lot about how we lost, Democrats lost young men in this election. And I think a huge part of that is like not because we focus on the wrong policies, but because we seem so risk averse and we seem so cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't think that in general, young men find that as attractive as a more risk on kind of say whatever you want attitude.
Okay, so I don't think, look, it's not just young men. I think it's more than young men. I think it's a lot of folks don't like that, that they're too scared, that they're too risk averse. A lot of folks don't like it. And that's part of the reason why Democrats lost, because they're too nervous and buttoned up. And another reason I believe that why many people are turning away from politics is because there are no people, there are very few people who are like Jack Salzberg. He's not in politics, but he comes from a political family. There should be more people like Jasmine Crockett, or there should be more people like AOC or Maxwell Frost or any of the younger folks who are in Washington. That people don't know when to step down, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, remember? Like Joe Biden. Like Mitch McConnell, like Dianne Feinstein. They just don't know, like, hey, it's time. And they stay in longer than they should, and they block people from coming in who can really make a difference. Now, I'm going to play this because I feel sorry for them, but, you know, this person had a medical episode, but this is some of the reason why people are saying, hey, look, know when it's time and just get some younger folks in there. But again, we hope that this gentleman is okay. It's sad because it happened to Mitch McConnell. It happened to Dianne Feinstein. It happened to a couple of people when they were in politics. And I just wanted to, you know, this is just an example of, you know, term limits. Here it is.
Don't worry, no one on the Republican side in the House and Senate who control both the House and Senate is going to speak up and challenge us. But we need to protect Americans' privacy and their social security. For 40% of all Americans, social security is the basis for their retirement and their retirement savings. And for 28 million Americans, Social Security is the only thing that they have. And that's why we have to make sure that we are protecting it as well.
So I saw a couple of people with their comments up on the screen. Why was no one helping him? That's what I don't understand either. And why didn't someone like walk up and stand next to him and say, you know, hey, representative, let's, you know. Do you know what I'm saying? Now, I'm not being an ageist or anything. I'm just saying that there's time. Sometimes you got to know when it's time. Am I wrong? And I don't know why term limits would help. And I don't know why. I really don't know why no one helped him. That's a serious problem, Lisa Abiola. You're right. And he kept going. Because people have lost their humanity, someone says. They want him to fumble.
This is part of the Don Lemon weekly podcast. It's something he calls Lemon Drops. And sometimes he does them in the morning, sometimes he doesn't. during different parts of the day, depending on what his topics are. So be sure to check him out on a regular basis. This is another example of some of the different things that are going on in Black America and with Ebony Spectrum as we look around the globe and give you some thoughts from our fellow broadcasters and ourselves. Thanks for listening.
The life of every child is precious beyond measure. If you care for a child with a disability and have limited income and resources, help is available. Children with a physical or mental disability or who are blind may qualify for monthly cash payments through the Supplemental Security Income Program, or SSI. The program provides help to meet basic needs for food, clothing, or a place to live, and disability-related needs. It's money that can make a meaningful difference. If you're the parent or caregiver of a child or teenager you think may be eligible, call Social Security at 1-800-772-1213 or visit ssa.gov/SSIKids to learn how to apply today. That's ssa.gov/SSIKids. It's real help for the children. Message produced by Social Security at U.S. taxpayer expense.
Ever lose your keys? Is that normal aging, dementia, or something else? Fear often stops us from asking for a simple checkup from the neck up. Knowing your numbers, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol are common, but your cognitive numbers are also important, especially if you're age 65 or older. Better to act sooner rather than later if you want to maintain or enhance your brain's health. Hello, I'm Kevin, president of the Dementia Society of America, a national nonprofit organization. I'm excited to offer you a free guide filled with tips for better brain health and important facts about dementia, care planning, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
WRCT.org. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Well, hello. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Riona Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh, that has been one of Riona's professors. Here comes part 2 of our discussion of translation and various other language issues.
Isn't there a sense between some different languages that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true, and of course it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. Whether, and that's, so you, there you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
It wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgian did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English did that as well. The Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism, but the language went with it. And now, you know, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language of everything, commerce, diplomacy, and the list goes on. Of course, when I first went over to Portugal, I went as a professional basketball player. Within 6 weeks, I had to give practices in Portuguese. That was not easy. I went back 20 years later, the small town where I first played and where, as I've mentioned, there were no English speakers. And I was invited to a game and then invited to go in and give a little talk to the team. So I walked into the locker room and started addressing them in Portuguese. And then I realized that other than two guys down at the end of the bench, no one knew what I was talking about. The coach was an Anglophone. All of the players, there were three Americans, two Lithuanians, a Spaniard, a Serb, and two Portuguese. Their entire universe was in English. This was in a small town in Portugal. And I said, oh, and spoke to them in English, you know.
It's interesting because, to your question, these power dynamics exist also within individual languages because of cultural imperialism and linguistic imperialism, which I'm so, you've elucidated so well, Chris. But, you know, I think about how when I was learning Spanish, I was learning Spanish in high school in South Texas, and I was taught Mexican Spanish as the default pronunciation and vocabulary words of choice. And it was not until many years later in college and in graduate school that I was really truly exposed to Spain-based Spanish and to Catalan and to other dialects of Spanish and became aware of the biases and the condescension and the tension between the languages that reflect this colonized-colonizer dynamic that I was very unaware of as a 13 and 14-year-old learning the language for the first time. But the same is even true, you know, we can think about just the geographic span between Mexico and Spain is vast. But those same dynamics might occur in modern Italian, where you have dialects in Rome that are different from the dialects in Naples, that are different from the dialects of Sicily. And generally speaking, the further south you get in Italy, the more derided by the northerners your dialect of Italian is likely to be. And this also reflects cultural power dynamics, because the closer you were to Milan, to Venice, to Rome, the more likely you were to have powerful connections as far back as the Crusades.
Don't we have that in America with the different accents and the dialects of English spoken here?
We do, but I would say I'm not sure it's as bad as in the UK, though, where you have the public school accent, meaning the private exclusive for the aristocracy and their descendants, and then working class, you know, East London accents and so forth. That's quite extreme differences. Of course, in French, you know, you've got Le Parisien and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, the French Revolution intent was a leveler. They wanted everyone to speak and write the same way. Well, people don't evolve that way. And, of course, they sent a bunch of people over to Quebec, then essentially cut them off without a dime for a century or so. So they evolved. And now when the Quebecers go back to France, they get insulted by, c'est pas du français, ça. It's not, that's not French.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In spite of the fact they are native speakers of French and have a really unique and beautiful, albeit very distinct way of expressing themselves.
Get the sense in America that the versions of English that are spoken in the African American, in the immigrant American community, are the ones that are really looked down on.
Yep. And in any lower economic bracket, for that matter, too. You point to the South, yeah. But it's, you know, there are class-based accents in the South. There are the Southern Belle versus the non-Southern Belle Southern accents, right? Or you might think, we're in Pittsburgh, we might think of the Appalachian accent as a good parallel,
right.
Where the Appalachian accent is distinct from, say, what you encounter in urban cities of the same space, same geographic space. It is interesting, yeah. Though. I know, I reset us to the year 100, but the prioritizing and the politicizing of one's primary language, of the language of the colonizer, it's not inevitable. There's this broader attitude, especially in those early centuries of contact between the Roman Empire as a colonizing power, and Greece, the mainland, and the extended Hellenic world, or the Oikoumene, as it was regularly called after the conquest of Alexander. Because when Alexander takes over the eastern half of the Mediterranean, he basically installs laissez-faire government systems. So in Persia, he says, you have satrapies, they can stay, but I want all of the decrees in Greek. And so you see the development of Koine Greek, which is common Greek. That's all that Koine means. When the Romans, specifically Julius Caesar, follow in the footsteps of Alexander and they take over the Oikoumene, where Koine Greek is already practiced as the default legal language, the Romans say, well, we can understand Greek, so this can stay as it is. So it's only in occasional spaces for specific legal purposes that you see Latin as the de facto legal language. So, for example, in Egypt, you see Latin being prioritized for divorce cases. But Egypt is an interesting space because most legal codes during the Roman Empire are left in Greek, but all tax codes are still in native Egyptian. Because Alexander was too busy taking over the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to rewrite the tax codes. But you end up with this Roman Empire that is a Latin-speaking population for its rulership, at least for the first 300 years or so, who are perfectly content to let the eastern half of the Mediterranean continue to use Greek.
That sounds like a different story than what Christopher was talking about when European countries colonized Africa or North America or South America.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's different. I'm not sure about the economic reality of, but I'm assuming that those conquerors also had in mind lucre, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the colonial system was a system of exchange of raw materials for manufactured materials to the benefit of the mother country. Once they got through all looking for gold and stuff with the Incas and the Mayas. But so there's that power imbalance, which always works in favor of the colonizer. And Alexander was not looking to lift up the populations for there.
Absolutely not. So it's the same colonizing force executed slightly differently on the linguistic plane.
Yeah.
Brianna, we've ended up talking about language as a window into seeing all sorts of different things about culture.
Well, I feel like the thing is that language is inherently powerful, and it inherently carries out power dynamics, whether that be the difference in accents, or and therefore a bunch of code switching, or imperialism, meaning that people now have to speak another language.
Well, the code switching notion, you know, is an interesting one. Code switching, in my experience, just means using multiple language in the same utterance, for example. And it's looked down upon in educated spaces, in other words, but is quite common. In my own experience, for example, in Portugal, it did not happen until very recently. But in Montreal, for example, you walk into a shop now, you know how you are greeted. Bonjour, hi.
Mm-hmm. Both.
Both. Now, for the defenders of the French language, this is a mortal insult, but it is daily practice in commerce. And that gives you, as the interlocutor of the salesperson, the option of saying, yeah, I'm looking for some socks, or je cherche des chaussettes, vous en avez dans ma taille. You can go either way. Mm-hmm. In other words, in Quebec, where there is the defense of the French language, which is often right in front of mind, that sort of flexibility is threatening. But you see code switching. In Montreal, most people are bilingual. And so they will routinely, if they can't think of a word in French, they will throw it in the English word. And then if you get into the arts, I did a lot of study of Francophone popular music, especially in Quebec, rap, for example. You can have people who will use an indigenous language, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English, not necessarily all in the same rap, but...
Potentially.
Yes. And often in multiples. And Creole, too, of course, because Creole is quite prevalent.
So you'd call it code switching when you're on the bus and you overhear somebody in a conversation in Arabic saying, okay, and...
And I think Christopher's very, very right to highlight that the more diverse or the more bilingual a space is, the more code switching can occur. And to Riona's opening point, it also doesn't have to happen between languages. It can happen within an individual language. So this gets into the dialects issue again, and also to cultural norms and socioeconomics, etc. But so, for example, in English, someone from South Texas, if I'm really like leaning into my roots, I might say, y'all fixing to eat yet? And in a academic setting, I would be very unlikely to say that same expression using those words in that cadence that quickly. I'd be more likely to say, are y'all about to eat? Or are you about to eat? Or are yins about to eat? And see, that's an additional code switch, because now I'm taking on the Pittsburgher cap and trying to utilize an indigenous term for y'all, the equivalent.
Well, that's the whole question of register, of course, yes. You know, so that code switching between registers. My experience being a jock, a musician, an academic, you know, and so you're talking to a bunch of hoopers, mm-hmm. There's going to be more profanity. You're going to be, the subjects that you discuss will be somewhat limited. Although I always defend intelligent jocks because they do exist.
And jock musicians apparently exist.
And jock musicians as well.
As well,
absolutely. So, but yeah, the registers, the social registers, which everybody knows, yes. Multiples, some maybe only two. They know that when they're talking to grandma,
right,
they're not supposed to swear.
Right. To your point, too, about the purpose of code switching, the purposes can vary. So Christopher's example is a utility-based code switch, saying bonjour, hi, so that your customer knows which language they can opt for, that there's aptitude in both, is utility-based. But you might be on the phone with your grandmother and utilize a native or a heritage term to refer to her instead of saying grandma. Or you might say Mitchin, for example, which is Flemish, as a tone of endearment. And then that is a code switch that is used for emotive purpose. Or you might use it because you're multilingual and you can't find the damn word that you're looking for in the language you're speaking, so it comes to your mind in Greek or in Latin or in French or in Chinese or etc. But what's cool, what's so interesting is that in sociolinguistics, they've determined that, generally speaking, you code switch either to create distance from someone. So you use a word because the people around you won't know what you're saying. Or you do it for the opposite reason, which is to create a closer connection with someone because you know, okay, if I switch to Creole French and you know what I'm saying, I've just created a connection with you. I've just flagged that we have this commonality. And so code switching is this beautiful subtext of language to operate within language.
So we're here on Forbes Avenue talking with Marcy Persine, who's assistant professor in classics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Christopher Jones, who's emeritus professor of French and Francophone studies here at CMU. We've really been talking about language in the mind and translation, so I thought I would ask if you had opinions about language that doesn't really go through human minds, like the role of AI in translation.
Well, machine or computer-assisted translation as a practice didn't arrive with AI. And when I came here in 93, for example, it was well underway in computer science and so forth. And you could say anything like Google Translate, or, you know, there are multiples that are there which are not as powerful and don't use anywhere near as much fossil fuel to to make them work. I worked in intelligent tutoring systems here with people from computer science. And so the whole notion of creating a body of knowledge and modeling that body of knowledge and releasing stimuli to students based on that constructed body of knowledge, which the computer was keeping track of, which a teacher also does, of course, but that's not foreign to me. What's happening with AI is the artificial intelligence is able to learn on its own if it's fed. And of course, as a songwriter and a writer, the artificial intelligence needs to be fed existing texts, which were actually authored by humans, but which ends up causing an enhanced capacity in the artificial intelligence, which it then can turn around and do Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Not really, but, you know, maybe not Shakespeare, but can do Queen.
It
can do a pastiche of Shakespeare and fool a lot of people. Previously, the computer would spit out something and you'd say, okay, yeah, give me a couple hours and I'll put this into a final shape. Now with AI, it's instead of being 75% final, it's now 97% final to the extent that a professor might not know that the paper written for that assignment was not actually written by Bobby or Janie, but rather Robobby, you know, so to speak.
Robobby.
I just made that up.
I love that, though. I really appreciate your point, especially about how generative AI and language corpus tools are by nature of how they are constructed. Machines designed for plagiarizing, right? They have to be fed something created by humans at some point in order to create something that is new, but all the parts are old. So in that sense, what ChatGPT or any of these AI tools do is they give you a quilt rather than a brand new fabric. And what humans can do with language is create a new fabric. That doesn't mean the quilt's not useful. And it doesn't mean that there's not, you know, potentially good purposes for AI, too, although your point about the fossil fuels and the energy consumption is also very on the nose because it's deeply alarming. In learning languages, if you are not thrust into a space of immersion, the fear of failure is such an obstacle. You know, to walk into even, like, Gabby et Jules and order in French in Pittsburgh is very challenging and frightening, but to go on Duolingo and speak into a mic and have a bot respond to you in what feels like more or less canned French, a conversation you might drill and practice until you know it, that can overcome the fear of failure. So, you know, generative AI is kind of regenerative rather than generative, to your point, but there are definitely some uses to it that feel less destructive, but there's also no actual originality to it as it exists right now.
Well, that's a good point, though, that it can assist people in learning the language or getting you a rough translation that you can get a native speaker to help you sort it out so you haven't offended anybody in that language.
Absolutely. It's a good starting point or a good intermediary for sure. In the same way that Google Translate can be a very useful intermediary to start with. Mm-hmm. So, but you also might get some confused looks when you start speaking French in the form of Voltaire, because Voltaire is, of course, copyright free. There might be some lingering aspects of it in ChatGPT that, you know, just surface from time to time.
What about the global media? How is that affecting all the current languages?
Well, I also consume media. Just because my work is in the ancient world doesn't mean I'm dead. I do still, you know, watch, you know, Miyazaki films or K-dramas, or as you see globalization occur and more and more and more materials in their original languages available, Turkish dramas. Oh my God, amazing. It's easier to put yourself into spaces of immersion where, you know, you can turn on the subtitles. But eventually you might be doing the dishes while you're watching your Turkish drama and realizing that, oh, I actually don't need to read these English subtitles as much as I thought that I did, because I've been binge watching 5 seasons of historic romance that's all in Turkish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to have the subtitles for those Hindi dramas I'm watching.
I guess you haven't watched enough.
Yeah, that's right.
This is me empowering you to watch more.
Just watch more, Richard.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think back. I mean, remember, how old is the internet?
Mm.
And how old is the World Wide Web? Not that old. Older than you are.
Yeah,
but, okay. But just barely, right? I mean, you know, the fact is, we're not talking Roman Empire here. We're talking very recent history. And one of the main concerns outside of Anglo-Saxon spaces was that the World Wide Web and the internet were going to be English, you know, and it was going to be another example of cultural and linguistic imperialism. And now that has not turned out to be the case, although there's still probably a predominance of English interaction, right? Even in international, between spaces who don't actually speak English. And of course, speaking, learning a language via media, that's not an easy way to go, because it's never easy to do that, but it is certainly feasible.
You know, something that we've sort of been circling around, and I'd love to pick everyone's brain about, is the role of education in the way that we prioritize language. You know, there are languages that we predominantly use in classrooms, and there are languages that are predominantly spoken in households or in churches or in community centers or in, you know, gatherings that are all elders or all women. And these sort of different spaces activate different power dynamics. So one of the reasons why English has this almost chokehold on Americans' linguistic capacity is because English is taught as the de facto language in every public school in the country.
But of course, in North America, Quebec is the counterexample, where math and science and history and so forth are taught in French.
Yes.
And yet they're constantly battling against the wave of English.
I get the sense that even by the time my son, who's in his mid-30s, by the time he was in high school in America, languages were devalued, and people were only taking them because they had to take 2 years to have on their application to a 4-year college.
Clearly, the value of language has shifted from my youth to today. Because the value of language, you could say, if I had actually been a Portuguese speaker, I could have gone right in, made myself I'm remembered for having integrated myself into Portuguese life. That was that massive effort with almost no preparation. Today, what would be the value of arriving with decent Portuguese? The Portuguese would speak to you in English. In France, I used to take students to a summer program. We'd arrive in Paris, and I'd say, hey, go get a coffee. We'll meet back here and take the train out to Strasbourg. They'd come back in tears, because the waitress had insulted their French in French. Mm-hmm. Now that same waitress would have spoken to them in English. They would have had no opportunity even to be insulted, you know. So that is a huge difference. And you speak of educationally. Well, how do you get that immersion experience if you're coming from an Anglophone environment? If you're coming from University of Pittsburgh, you're coming from Carnegie Mellon, and you're going to a major European capital, people will speak to you in English mm-hmm. the moment they hear an accent.
I had a friend recently who studied abroad in France, and she didn't speak a lick of French while she was there. She said the only thing she had to be careful was in the line to the club. Mm-hmm. If she spoke English, she might get turned away. But if she had her friends without accent speak, then she could get in and continue living French free.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's a classic story where the American kids go over and they all hang around in a cloud and just speak to each other and don't actually get any immersion experience whatsoever. But that was a lot harder to do even 20 years ago or so.
Although I do also wonder, I am just as prone to this as anyone else, so I promise I'm not pointing fingers, but with the rise of travel influencers on Instagram sending us to further and further obscure places off the beaten track, as it were, you know, I feel like it might be difficult to speak French in Paris, but it might be difficult not to speak French if you are outside of one of these major metropolitan spaces in France. And, you know, to circle back to the question of what the value of these languages are and learning second and third and fourth languages, you know, we could talk about, you know, the ways in which, say, you know, learning computer coding helps your brain develop different ways, new wrinkles, as I like to put it.
Or Christopher and I would say learning to play music develops
exactly,
different things.
Exactly. Or learning mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have calculators in our phones. Why do we need to learn basic multiplication rules? Well, it helps your brain develop, and it helps you hold different forms of critical thinking. And that's kind of getting on the higher tier of pedagogical reasoning for why languages are important. But there's also this fact that, you know, as much as the U.S. seems like a monolinguistic space, and as much as English is a lingua franca, there will always be people in the world you can't speak to unless you reach out and try to learn at least hello, bonjour, you know, ni hao, whatever language it is. And maybe that's your grandmother. Maybe that's your aunt. Maybe that's, you know, the person sitting next to you on the train who's reading a book that looks really interesting. Perhaps, you know, having these tools at our fingertips that can give us shorthands for translations can make, you know, those moments more approachable without the language learning. But I think the language learning is still important, so you know how to use the tools, know what is the appropriate way to implement the tools. Yeah, it's such a good question.
This has just been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Marcy Person from Pitt, and Christopher Mark Jones from CMU.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
That was an utter joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Hello. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Well, hello. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Hello. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road in everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Oh. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road in everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Oh. Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road in everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
CT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you the best music.
There are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship.
That's P. Sineth, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features P. Sineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style. India, the world's most populous country, is ruled by Narendra Modi, who is the head of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. He first became prime minister in 2014 and has been re-elected twice since, though in 2024 with much lower margins. Before coming to power in Delhi, he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where he presided over a major massacre of Muslims. Modi and the BJP promote Hindutva, Hindu majoritarianism. It is laced with Islamophobia. Modi is allied with India's billionaire class, who control the country's major media and function as cheerleaders for a regime that gags democracy, free speech, and dissent. Our guest today is P. Sineth. He's an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. "I cover the people," he says, "who live at the bottom end of the spectrum." He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. He gave the Harish Sharma Memorial Lecture at the Surrey Public Library in Surrey, British Columbia, in early October. And now, P. Sineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style.
A few months ago, just before the national elections, our Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, discovered and declared that he had understood after his mother's passing that he was not biologically born. Yeah? And had in fact been installed by God to show all the rest of us whatever he has been showing us. So, when we are talking about governance by gagging, and I'm going to race a bit, there are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. And one of them you saw immediately after that wonderful statement of the Prime Minister, not a single newspaper wrote a single editorial, not a single anchor on any channel made any kind of critical comment when the head of the nation says that he is non-biologically born. You know, it's just as if they didn't hear it. He said it out loud and clear. The gagging is of a particular, of one of the five types that I'm going to talk about. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media, which, like in the case of the Prime Minister's not biologically born and of divine origin, I mean, I think there were at least some interesting doctrines to be gone into when you are of divine origin. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality, which to my mind is the main source of the gagging, because it didn't just start on 2014 with Mr. Modi. That's not true. That's not accurate. It's been going on. It's raced in the time of Mr. Modi, but ever since we embraced neoliberalism in 1991, the different sources of gagging have grown immeasurably. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship. The fear. How many people who know better are remaining silent because it's bloody prudent and sensible to remain silent. Okay, so those are broadly the five ways. Let me show you the first, gagging by laws. And, you know, one of the ways of silencing people is that it requires just the selective silence of the judiciary. Would you believe that the Delhi High Court has held that Inqilab Zindabad is an incendiary and inflammatory statement, and you can go to jail for it if they feel that you used it in a violent context? Inqilab Zindabad, coined by Maulana Hasrat Mohani, was the rallying cry of the Indian freedom struggle. Long live the revolution. Here is the Delhi High Court. This is in the case of poor Umar Khaled. Umar Khaled has been denied bail I don't know how many times. And one of his problems, of course, is that he has a Muslim name. That's a serious issue and indicative, doubtless, of criminality. So look at what they're saying here. Huh? During the course of argument, issues were raised relating to the content, context, and use of certain phraseology in the speech of the appellant. This is the High Court of Delhi, which prima facie appeared to be incriminating per se, as also as inflammatory. The court goes on to say, however, this court is not impressed by the argument of the appellant, inasmuch as the call to revolution does not have to affect only the immediate gathering. The call to revolution may affect many beyond those who were visibly present, which is why this court finds it apt to mention Robespierre, who was at the vanguard of the French Revolution. This court is of the view that possibly, if the appellant had referred to Maximilien Robespierre for what he meant by revolution, he must have also known what revolution meant for our freedom fighter and first prime minister. The very fact that Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru believed that democracy had made revolution superfluous, by the way, Nehru used that slogan many times himself in the 30s. That democracy has made revolution superfluous after independence, and how it meant to the complete opposite of a bloodless change. Revolution isn't by itself always bloodless, which is why it is contradistinctly used with the prefix of bloodless revolution. So when we use the expression revolution, it is not necessarily bloodless. They're finding a way to say that Umar Khalid's slogan, Inkilab Zindabad, which is in every Indian trade union meeting that you can imagine at the beginning and at the end, was somehow an incitement to violence. A revolution in its essential quality may not be different, but from